Hey guys, welcome to Entrepreneurs Uncut. Today we have Dominic Lacerdo on the show, and he's the founder and co-managing director of Stanford Capital. Being the son of an accountant entrepreneur, business was in Dom's blood at an early age. Throughout the episode, we unpack his successful career in finance and the moment that he realized corporate life was no longer for him, giving rise to his first business, Stanford Capital. Since then, the business has grown from strength to strength, all while staying true to those deeply held values. Dom generously shares his wisdom in the episode, and the passion for his team at Stanford really shines through. I hope you enjoy it. Let's get to the show. Dominic Lacerdo, welcome to Entrepreneurs Uncut.
Hi, Matt. Nice to be here.
Thanks, mate. Thanks for coming on the show.
No, you're welcome. Looking forward to it.
Mate, maybe to kick us off, I like to do this with all my guests. I like to go back, delve into the past, maybe take it a few years back now and ask you maybe a little bit about it. Help us listeners understand a little bit more about your background, where you've come from. What was it like to grow up in the Lacerdo household?
I had a great childhood, to be honest. I was very fortunate. Eldest of three boys, so I've got two younger brothers. Family, my father's Italian, as you probably can work out from the surname. He was born in Sicily and immigrated to Australia as a young boy. He was three or four when he came to Australia, so doesn't have any sort of direct memories of Italy. And mum's Australian background, so I kind of got the best of both worlds there, I have to say. So I hung out with both the Wogs and the Aussies growing up in school, which was good. I think we had a great childhood. We lived, and my parents still do live in Sydney, in Abbotsford, and we spent all our childhood in the bay there, Hen and Chicken Bay.
Yeah.
Our holidays, school holidays, were very much around just hanging out with the kids in the neighbourhood. It seemed to be a lot freer back in those days than it is today, as we used to walk out of the house at 7 in the morning and come back at 7 at night, daylight savings time. Maybe pop home for lunch if we were hungry. we had a great time, mate. We were very fortunate. And I think also I had the blessing of having my grandparents live next door to me as well. So my father's parents and my nonna and nonno lived next door to me as well. So I certainly had influence from not just my father and mother, but also from my grandparents who lived immediately next door. I mean, I can't, they've both passed away now, unfortunately, my grandparents, but I don't remember a day them not being next door, if I can put it that way. And they had a pretty profound bearing on my life, I think, the way I grew up, I suppose.
Right. Your grandparents did they?
Yeah. I mean, they were always around, right? Dad worked bloody hard, and he's got a really interesting background, actually. He sort of never went to university, but became a motor mechanic and ultimately an accountant. So back in the day, you were able to get qualified as an accountant without a university degree, and was really, I guess, the first of his family to go down the pathway of a profession, because the rest of the family were, fishermen or builders. And not there's anything wrong with that. They're great professions in their own right. But, I think he, as a consequence of that, had a fair bearing on the pathway that I went down as a younger man. My grandparents were, with my dad working so much, he would literally work 6 days a week. My grandparents were around a lot. Mum worked a little bit here and there, but she didn't have to work full time, which was great. So she was always there for us, coming home from school and making us lunches and, I don't know, we were ravenous as boys when we got back from school.
Yeah, three boys.
Yeah, it's funny. My father used to own racehorses. He tells this story once we got to teenagers, he either had to get rid of the horses or get rid of the boys because he couldn't afford to keep both. So yeah, fortunately for us, he gave up the racehorses, I suppose.
Gosh, you're lucky. And I'm interested in understanding your grandparents. Were they really encouraging your dad to get into that white collar work, that more professional? Was it coming from them, or did your dad have it inside of him? Was it self-directed?
It's probably a bit of both. Certainly my grandmother was a huge believer in education. And neither of my grandmother or grandfather, as my father's parents, went very far at school, right? I think my grandfather finished in first class and my grandmother maybe finished in third class. And that's just the way it was, right?
Yeah.
Back in the day. And I guess like all parents, you want your children to do more than you did. You want to give them more than you had growing up. And I certainly see that with my daughters now, my two daughters. But my grandma was very big on pushing my father into education and wanting him to further himself in terms of education. And I think, you know, he was a big beneficiary of that. But at the same time, it was, you know, choices that he had to make. His brothers, for instance, they both became builders. And terrific builders. They were great builders, but they obviously decided that's the pathway that they wanted to go down versus going down the, I guess, a career that involved education and ongoing education, right? You can't become an accountant and stop. You become an accountant and you continue to develop your skills and you continue to learn and you continue to become a professional from there. But then, you know, Dad was always really interested in business, which I think has had a fairly profound influence on me as well. He, through that time, had involvement in a number of different businesses, from blind manufacturing, retailing, wholesaling. We started a business together when I was in my late teens, which I'm sure we'll get to, which was in the shutters business after I finished my university degree. Sorry, not late teens, early 20s it was. He's always had an active involvement and interest in business, including having built his own accounting practice, right?
Yeah.
So we were always surrounded by business. It's not like something that was foreign to us as kids, and I guess we lived and breathed it. I mean, it wasn't always plain sailing. There were testing times in the late 80s when financial troubles struck the economy, that Dad lost money on businesses. He had to liquidate businesses.
That he had a shareholding in.
Yeah, absolutely.
Right.
He was a very early shareholder in the furniture game as well. Interestingly, with some families that have gone on to build really big businesses in the furniture space, like Nick Scali, for instance. He was a partner of Nick Scali's for a while.
Right.
And, like, there's a whole – you should do a podcast on my old man, mate. There's a whole bunch of stories there.
Sounds like he was quite entrepreneurial. He didn't just want to do the books. He also sounded like had a love for the business behind the numbers. Would that be a fair thing to say?
He loved business. He still does love business. I mean, even now, you know, he's retired from the accounting practice and he's sold out of the businesses that he was involved in. But, you know, every time he and I catch up, he asks me how the business is going. And he's great. Actually gives me perspective as an external. Obviously, he's interested and he's vested in my success, but he's also independent in that sense and can bring perspective, which often I don't see, right? I think sometimes you gain perspective through the affluction of time and experience. And whilst I'm 47 and I've seen a bit, I certainly haven't seen it all. I'm learning a hell of a lot still, and I still feel like I'm on a long pathway of learning. But, yeah, to answer your question, Dad had a love for business and still has a love for business. I think it's the challenge, you know, the solving problems which all business owners encounter almost all the time. There's something cropping up, right? The idea of creating something in particular he was particularly interested in and wanted to succeed in. And so, you know, almost by osmosis, I definitely absorbed that love of his that he had for business.
I was going to say, when did those conversations start to happen? Was it in those teenage years? When did you and your dad start to converse in that vein of business?
We were working. Dad always had us working, right? So, I remember my brothers and I cleaning out factories, washing windows. When we had to move factories that Dad had, we would, this is as kids, right? I don't know. I was probably 12. My two brothers were 11 and 7. We just had to chip in, right? That was just how it worked. So we were always working. The concept of business, it's a little strange, right, when you're a young kid. Like the concept of work, you got a lot of easier. It's easier to understand, you know. You do a job, you get paid for it, whereas business, it's a bit more granular, a bit more esoteric, I suppose. So we were always working. From a young age, we were always doing stuff, and even around the house, right? There was no lazing around the house, not doing anything. We were gardening or mowing lawns, or chores were just built into us. And I think that strong work ethic is evident in all three of us boys, myself and my two brothers. And even sort of working outside of the family, I remember as a, I don't know, 11 or 12 year old, I wanted a new bike, and Dad said, "Well, what's wrong with the old one?" And I said, "Well, I really want a new one." He said, "Well, I'm not buying you a new one." So I just went out and found myself a job at the local pharmacist delivering medicines. The irony was you needed a bike to deliver them, deliver the medicines, right? So, but I used my old bike for a little while. It still functioned. But after a couple of months of earning, I don't know what I was earning, $3 an hour or something, it was pittance, right? I saved up and was able to buy myself a new bike, and it was good, mate. Like I think Dad, it was a bit of a lesson in that for us, for me, without me even realizing it, right? Dad was, well, if you want something, you got to go out and get it, mate, you know? Like you can't sit back and wait for it to come to you, and you're not going to get it as a gift from me. Like go out and earn it. So, you're reflecting on it, and at the time you think, well, why can't you just get me the bike, you know? But there's value in those lessons that you take away and you appreciate over time that you just don't appreciate in the instant that you're not being gratified with whatever it is that you want.
That's right.
Yeah. So
old school lessons.
Yeah, and Dad had a bit of that. Like my grandfather was a hard man, you know, like
right.
He raised his boys. He had three sons as well. So my father was the youngest of three boys. He raised his boys really hard, as a lot of the old ethnic communities do, right? And particularly ethnic fathers, they raise their sons in a very disciplined way. And that definitely filtered through my father to us boys. We were raised very much on the straight and narrow. There's no doubt about that. We copped plenty of hidings as kids when we made mistakes. I could tell you that much. But at the same time, there was plenty of love, mate. So that balance that ethnic families tend to have is something that, again, reflecting on, you probably don't. I probably don't think about it enough, but it was a delightful childhood to grow up with. So we didn't come back to your question. We always talked about work, and I always understood the concept of work from the very beginning, and the value of money. It wasn't something that, as my father says, you just go and take from the back of the yard or from the tree. So I always understood work, and then I guess I started getting interested in financial markets from a teenager. I certainly liked the stock market, the idea of the stock market, that you could make right. money just by investing, and so started learning about the financial markets more broadly.
This is the 80s?
Is in the 80s. Like, I watched Wall Street in the 80s, and I don't know if you remember seeing that movie, but that actually had a pretty profound influence on me.
Gordon Gekko,
exactly. You know, greed is good, that all that stuff. And again, probably at the time I thought, man, this is fantastic. Like, this is a world of extravagance and exuberance and, you know, fast pace. And, of course, as a teenager, you're probably looking for a bit of that stuff. And I realized over time that, you know, it was a movie. it wasn't real. And there's, you know, the irony of that movie is that there's a deep meaning behind it, right, which is around integrity. The role that's played by the father of the main character, around him being the union guy and looking after the staff and doing the right thing versus the young buck who's just out to make a quick dollar and do it the wrong way. I took a lot out of that, the importance of having integrity, the importance of doing the right thing, and that continues to have a pretty profound way influence on not only the way I think, but the way the businesses that I'm involved in operate and think as well. So, it's funny how moments in time, events can influence you, you know. But that was certainly something that I was attracted to, and financial markets were always interesting, you know. I didn't really understand it as a teenager, and I don't profess to understand financial markets that much more. They're very complicated, but I've certainly found a part of those financial markets that I'm actively involved in now. I was lucky, mate. I was always a good student, so I always got good grades, even from, you know, junior years. The education that I had allowed me to, it gave me options, right? That's what I tell my daughters. Mm-hmm. Education just gives you options. It allows you to have choice as opposed to have choice forced upon you, because if you don't have the education, you don't have the choice. So I very much... I loved high school. A lot of my great mates are still high school mates. I did very well in high school, which allowed me to matriculate to university and study commerce at New South Wales. I was the first of the grandchildren on both sides of my family to go to university, to finish university.
Wow.
So that was a proud moment. I remember graduating my undergraduate degree, and fortunately my grandmother had passed away at that stage, and taking my grandfather to lunch, and in fact he, with a few of my mates, it was my postgraduate degree, he bought lunch. Yeah, so he was there was 10 of us, and he was just so proud to know that his grandson had finished university. It was it was a terrific moment, a great moment in my life, and again something that I'm really proud of.
Absolutely. I could bet. It makes me even think for myself. I think on my side, similar story, not for undergraduate degree but postgraduate degree. I think it was a bit of a highlight for me too, so I can understand what you're talking about there. And it's interesting, you went into university, a commerce, accounting degree. Were you just always going to go that path, or were you also influenced by what your old man had done and wanted to follow in the footsteps? What was in your mind making those decisions in those early years?
Yeah, great question. I think, to be honest, I had no idea. So I studied accounting finance majors with my commerce degree. And you know, the commerce finance world, it's just enormous, right? It's not like you're studying physiotherapy and then you become a physiotherapist, right? It's so broad in its appeal. And that's part of the attraction, right? It does give you further choice. But the challenge then is narrowing down, right? So I finished my undergraduate degree. I must say I didn't do particularly well in my undergraduate degree. I did okay, but certainly nowhere near as well as I did in high school. And probably because I was a little unsure, probably because I was a little lost in that sense, like where am I going with my career? What does this degree even mean? What do I do with it? You know, Dad still had the accounting practice at that stage. He wanted me to overtake the practice, which I guess flirted with. When I finished my undergraduate degree, I had been working, so I worked all the way through my university degree. I'd saved up a bit of money. As I said, I really didn't know what I wanted to do. A mate of mine, really good mate of mine, is still a good mate of mine, Raz, said to me, university mate, said, I'm going to go traveling for a while. Do you want to come traveling? And I said, sounds pretty good. So we went to Europe. Originally, I was going for 3 months. I ended up staying for a year. So,
wow.
So I traveled, you know, all through Europe. So I don't know, probably 30 countries I went to. Based myself in Florence for 6 months. So I studied Italian for 3 months, which was a terrific experience. I'd never studied Italian formally before. I'd certainly spoken Sicilian with my grandparents and with my father, but had never. I'd resisted studying Italian as a child. I wanted to be an Aussie, you know. I didn't want to identify myself as an Italian. But you know, obviously, as you get older, you realize the importance of roots and history and culture. And so after I finished my undergraduate degree, having been given that opportunity to travel overseas, and then I met someone and they said it was they were studying Italian in Italy, and I'm thinking, oh, that sounds pretty good. And so I rang Dad because I needed a bit of money to top up, and he was gracious enough at that stage to not say to me, well, you go out and earn the money. He said, okay, I'll pay for it. So that was 3 months in Florence where I learned and just immersed myself in Italian, which is brilliant, right? Like if you're going to learn a language, I can honestly say it's the only way to learn it, because you end up living and breathing the language. And I got to a point where I was dreaming in Italian, right? So
wow.
So then the next 3 months I worked in the Mercato San Lorenzo, the leather jacket market there in Florence, selling leather jackets just to make money to sort of tie me over until summer came. And then my middle brother came over, Adrian, he joined me in Europe, and we sort of spent the next 3 months traveling. So yeah, I was away for a year, which, you know, was a great time in my life and certainly something that I never even contemplated probably until the week before I made the decision that I was going to go.
That's a big call.
It is a big call. And, you know, also I was sort of focused on money and success and driving and those sort of things to make the decision to go overseas. It was so very different to my character at that stage. But I can honestly say it was the very best thing I've ever done. Like, just independence, self-reliance, you know, just eyes wide open. You know, I often say I experienced like a whole lifetime of learning in a year, and when I came back, like nothing had changed, you know, like it was like same people, same dramas, same things, you know, same people going out with the same people at the time. Like it was like I was in a time warp.
Yeah, you know? And you didn't miss out on anything.
Didn't miss a thing. Honestly, I got back and I thought, well, I've just experienced this whole sort of life-changing influence on my life, and you guys are exactly where you were a year ago. You know, like nothing's changed. It was pretty extraordinary, and certainly I didn't anticipate that outcome, right? And I'm a bit like that. I think one of the things I've learned through my time is I'm really open to change and open to new ideas and thought. And I often say to myself that perhaps I don't know the right answer. Perhaps this isn't. I'm quite doubtful, and doubts are sometimes frowned upon as a thought process. But ironically, I actually feel like it's a bit of a super weapon for me, because with that doubt, it allows me to explore. Right, so. Maybe this isn't the right approach. Who do I need to speak to discover if it is? I'm probably getting a little bit off topic here, but
no, it's good. Yeah. It's good. It's made me think of when you were spending that year away in Europe, doing all that traveling. I'm sure having a great time. Did you sometimes reflect on some of those doubts? Maybe those doubts that you were having in your undergraduate degree. You mentioned that you were maybe a little bit unsure. Did you feel like that year gave you a bit of time to kind of set a plan in place to be a little bit more certain about the future?
Yeah.
Where you wanted to go?
It definitely did. I mean, it was probably something that had to get out of my system one way or the other, right? So so I got it out of my system, and when I came back, I did have a little bit more clarity, albeit I wasn't certain at that stage, because I then started studying law. Probably because other people thought it would be a good idea, not necessarily me.
Yeah.
And quickly realized actually only after a semester that law wasn't for me. So then I ended up saying to Dad, well, and he had business up in Queensland at that stage, and he actually said to me, Dom, why don't you go and work as an accountant for the blind business, so the window furnishing business that he had.
Okay.
Up there, which was manufacturing, wholesale, retailer, right? So covered fully vertically integrated.
Yep.
So I went up there. I was, probably 21, 22 at that stage. First time I'd moved out of home, other than obviously being overseas traveling. First time I moved out of home, Australia. Lived with some new people up there. Again, new experiences. But really quickly worked out that accounting, just wasn't my thing, mate, you know. As much as my dad wanted me to overtake the practice, there had to be a discussion where I said to him, Dad, I'm not taking the practice over. And it was pretty devastating for him, because neither of my brothers were studying accounting and ever had any intentions of doing it. So I was the only one who could have taken it over. But Dad was, what's to say, he was devastated. He was really good about it. Like, he said, Dom, mate, this is at 21. You're your own man. You're your own man, mate. You need to find your own path. You need to make those decisions, and, I respect you for it. And so after a couple of years working it took me a little while. It was about 18 months, actually. But, again, it was an interesting time on reflection, because – it taught me a lot about business. You know, up until that stage, I'd been working, I'd done the academic side of things, but never started a business, never really worked in a business. And so I'd learned a lot about business in that 18-month period. And, of course, being an accountant, you see a lot, right? You see through the whole organization.
Yeah.
And we did start a new business whilst we were up there, which was a sort of plantation shutter business, which involved – import, export, and letters of credit, and some stuff which at the time I had absolutely no idea about. But it is interesting how I can still draw upon some of those learnings in the current business. So then I came back to Sydney and thought, well, I've done the accounting thing. That's not for me. I'm going to go down the finance route. So I ended up getting a job at ANZ. In the commercial property finance area, not by choice. Again, I just wanted to try finance. It wasn't necessarily property, was something that I was you know, massively passionate about or anything at that stage. And so, started working at ANZ. And I have to say, those sort of 5-6 years at ANZ, and again, where I was pretty green, are pretty formative years. And still to this day, a lot of the people who mentored me and gave me guidance through that period are still close friends and colleagues that we grew up with. And as again, we were young 20s, you know, working in Martin Place in the city. It was our version of Wall Street. Yeah, that's for sure. We had a great time. You know, we learned a lot, played hard, worked hard. I think we worked in a business that was very successful at the time, and had a great culture under stewardship of a couple of great leaders, which Paul O'Hearn and Chris Rees in particular, and Mark Gleeson, who I still see. Like we go catch up on an annual sort of golf tour once a year, and they were all Mark's still going, but the other guys are retired. So yeah, it's nice to be able to draw upon and remember people who've had influence on you over your life. And the time at ANZ was terrific. Like I was on a leadership program there, which put me on the pathway to executive leadership within the bank, to be honest, if I wanted to stay on that path. But after 6 years at the bank, I did want to try something new. Again, I had developed more of a passion for finance then, and I knew that finance was the thing that I wanted to do. But even then, finance is such, you know, what's finance, right? Like,
yeah,
it's so broad. So, and I probably was fortunate that I worked in property finance, because it sort of ignited a passion for property finance, which is obviously the businesses that I'm involved in today. And interestingly, you then start building out networks and relationships and customers and clients at that young age, which I still connected with, 20 years later, 25 years later. So, I think it's that was a great time in my life. And so I left ANZ, ended up working for a smaller sort of boutique business called Gresham Partners.
Okay.
Only for a very short period, and then joined a sort of real estate debt advisory business called Ash Morgan Winthrop in their funds management space. So by that stage, I'd been working up and down the, the capital stack, conscious of the audience here. So doing first mortgages and second mortgages and a little bit in the equity space with clients in real estate. Ash Morgan was a really interesting experience, because I joined there in 2006, end of 2006, and then by the end of 2007, obviously the world started crumbling. So I saw the last hurrah, so to speak, of market exuberance, and then the GFC hit. So I then spent the next four and a bit years basically dealing with problems. So, cleaning up.
At that company.
At Ash Morgan, yeah. So cleaning up problematic loans, cleaning up, and this is all on our balance sheet at that stage. So deals that we had invested in that had come under pressure, dealing with borrowers that were facing bankruptcy, dealing with assets that had plunged in values and we're obviously facing losses, and our investors were facing losses at the time. Again, terrific learning experience. I wouldn't necessarily wish it on anybody, because it was bloody hard and it was exhausting and draining, like we had we had borrowers that committed suicide. So
wow.
We had to deal with people who, it was real, right? We weren't dealing with faceless institutions. This was having a profound impact on people's lives, and we were influencing to some degree what was happening in terms of those outcomes as we were trying to or attempting to recover those monies. So it was a hard time, but again, reflecting on it, probably had and has had a huge influence on me today in terms of sorry, I just had a call coming through. Apologies. In terms of you know, how I assess risk now, how I measure risk, how I invest the firm's money that we and our investors' money that we manage now.
Can I just ask? Sounds like the time at ANZ and building up your career, it was a process that you started to kind of fall in love with that finance. I know finance is a broad subject, but you're really starting to move in that direction. And then the GFC happened, and then you explained how those 4 years was great for learning but painful and some really confronting moments. During that 4 years, did you ever lose that interest and that passion in finance coming up against some of those hard situations?
No, I didn't, interestingly. I think I just felt it was part of the cycle. So you just can't be a financier in good times, right? Because the reality is
that would have been your first bad time, though. Was that right?
That was my first really bad time. Yeah. So I joined I finished high school in 91, right? So joined the workforce in 94, 95. And so we'd really recovered from that late 80s recession at that stage. But I was aware of the recession, like we learned about it in high school, right?
Yep.
And I saw the effects that it had on Dad and people around me at the time. But it was the first one that I'd been in the workplace where people around me were there one day and they weren't there the day after, right? So, and the effect that it can have on businesses, particularly businesses that are overexposed and over-leveraged, which we were at the time, which Ash Morgan was at the time, in my view. And so I think I guess there was that risk that you sort of lose the passion and do you change. But no, I never did. I guess I viewed it as I often do, as a learning opportunity, and I did learn a lot from it, as I said earlier. I think the lessons I'm still applying today. What I did take away from it was I think I can do things better, and this is, I guess, where the business side of me started kicking in. I mean, my career is really interesting. I mean, again, when I was at university, I guess I had this idea that my career would be working in corporate Australia, you know, like going to be a CEO of one of the banks or something, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, I had no idea what that meant, right, or how I was going to get there. But kind of that's the way uni is, right? It doesn't well, certainly the degree that I did, it was commerce. It wasn't, you know, business studies. I hadn't really contemplated starting my own business. I'd seen the ups and downs that Dad had had. It wasn't something that sort of entrepreneurial spirit wasn't alive in me from a young age. It was really about just succeeding in whatever it was that I was doing. But again, you know, if you sort of map my career out and reflect on it a little bit, I started working for ANZ, which had at the time probably 40,000 staff. The next organisation that I worked for had probably 400 or 500 staff. Ash Morgan had 100 staff. And when I started Stanford, it had myself. So there was this continual progression in working for smaller and smaller organisations. And when I finished at Ash Morgan, which was 2010, I took some time off because I was sort of mentally drained, and it had an effect on me. So I actually took sort of 3-4 months off, went overseas with my wife, with our girls at that stage, and just reflected and really used the time. It was a great time in my career. It was the first and only time where I stopped. You know, I'd always gone from one job to the next. Notwithstanding, I took that year off, gap year, I suppose, after I did my undergraduate degree. It was the first time between jobs that I'd stopped. And, you know, as a father of two young girls at the time, you carry this burden of wanting to provide for the family and all that stuff, which is obviously really important and has an effect on me. I thought, you know what, I'm just going to stop for a couple of months and just reflect on where it is I am, what I've learned, what I can do, where I'm going to go next. And even at that stage, I must say, it wasn't necessarily clear in my mind that I was going to start a business. And so I used that sort of 3-4 month period just to sort of reconnect with people, just connect with some of those people that I mentioned earlier, that from ANZ, from other organisations that I'd worked with, from my former colleagues and consultants that I'd worked with, and just sort of chatted to them about where I was, where I wanted to go. And through those discussions, I guess, Stanford was born. And at the same time, I had been sort of chatting with my now business partner, Michael Hines, around potentially starting something together. And I guess through those conversations, we ended up, starting Stanford. So, there's a whole other journey beyond that, right? but even then, I have to say, Mark, I've learned a lot about business over the last 11 years since we started Stanford, but I had no idea, honestly. I didn't even know what a business was at that stage. All I knew was I just knew we had to make money, right? So
yeah.
I just knew we had to do deals. Yeah. So we didn't have a balance sheet. We had some relationships with capital. And just to explain what Stanford is, the primary business, it's evolved a little bit since we started it. But when we started the business, it was a commercial mortgage broking business. Effectively, we had to find people who needed money and find people who had money and put them together, right? All in commercial real estate and across the sectors, so residential property, industrial, retail, commercial office, et cetera. So what we had, what Mike and I had at the time was, a bunch of relationships, no balance sheet. We wrote a business plan, interestingly, and sort of just templated a business plan and wrote it out from there. But there is a few things in that business plan which I think have held the business in great stead over the years. One was we wrote out what we now call values, but I guess what we called at the time were just principles. Things like, we would always treat our staff with respect. We would always operate at the highest level of integrity. Words to that effect, which have then evolved to become values for the organization. And obviously we did the financial planning, and which was useless because we had no idea. And it was 2010, and it was hard. It was probably the very worst time to start a business. There was no money around. Unlike today, where it was almost the opposite problem. Everyone was nervous. Everyone was still sort of recovering from what was, one of the largest single economic collapses in history, but for the 1929 crash, right? So
yeah.
I think, and again, it was probably the worst time but the best time, right, because it forced us, I don't know how many calls we'd make every day, I don't know how many people we would see, but we just worked so bloody hard in those first 12 months I was still working hard, but those first 12 months in particular.
Yeah,
and got a few deals done, but weren't paying ourselves anything meaningful. We were eating into our mortgages pretty quickly, I've got to say.
Yeah,
and we're then, I guess, fortunate enough to win a few mandates. I had a relationship with a capital partner out of Singapore, interestingly, which at the time looked at Australia and said, "Well, this is a really great place to be investing," but didn't have the ability to be able to sort of originate and execute deals down here. And there's a very high fee paying deal which basically underwrote the business for the next year or so when we got that done. And that saw us up and running, right? We were then able to hire some staff and sort of build the business from there.
I've got to ask, Dom, it's such a fascinating moment in your career and obviously the genesis of your business. Just taking it back a step or two, you could have easily gone back into corporate or a similar size business as you had been the few years before that, but you chose to take the leap and set up Stanford. Can you recall why?
Yeah, I can. And it's still poignant in my mind. I just didn't ever – well, I hated what corporate Australia had become. So the bureaucracy, the inefficiencies, the poor culture, the politics, just the bullshit, you know. I hope I can – that's not too sweary.
No, mate. Entrepreneurs aren't cut here.
Just the bullshit that goes on in large organisations, not just large organisations, all organisation sizes that aren't run properly, that don't stand for something, that whose people aren't respected properly, you know, and whose cultures are poor. And a big motivator, like a really big motivator for both Michael and I at the time was we are not going back to the corporate world ever. Like I remember, so our office, so I started the business in the third bedroom of my old house, and thought, oh, this is no good, because I had daughters knocking on my door. You know, I'm on important phone calls and they're wanting to come in because daddy's at home and play, which, you know, completely understand their perspective, but I realised I needed to get out of the house and into an office, so couldn't afford one. So I rang a mate who was a lawyer in town and said, mate, can I borrow some space from you? He said, yeah, sure, no problem. So he set me up, which was really great. Dom Calabria, his name is, from Bridges Law Firm. He gave me this little corner, and Mike and I sort of started in that little corner, but it was in it was down a circular quay. So I live in Cabarita and lived in Cabarita at the time. So I'd catch the ferry in and I'd look up and I'd see the building I was in, and I'd promise myself every morning that I'd walk in those early years, I'm not going back to the corporate world. Like, I'm not going. So a big motivator was, it wasn't about the money, it wasn't even about driving success for the business. It was just, I hated the rubbish, bullshit culture that goes on in corporate Australia, and I wanted to run away from it a million miles an hour.
Sounds like the best way that you could have done that was obviously starting your own, and not only starting your own business, but starting them on the pillars of those principles that you mentioned, respect and integrity. Am I right?
Yeah, yeah. There's so the principles we started on were trusted advisor, respect, integrity, fun, innovation. Considered is about risk, and community. So they're the words that I guess those principles evolved to, and they're still evolving, right? The reality is, as business changes, those principles and those values and the why, you know, it does evolve, it does change, and the business is today a very different business than it was 11 years ago, right? But yeah, you're right. I mean, I could have easily gone and got a job somewhere and started working, but I would have been in the same bullshit scenario, right?
Like, yeah.
But it wasn't easy, I've got to say. I think one of the challenges, you know, relatively highly educated professional people face is their salary is so appealing, right?
Yeah.
You know, you make good money, you're safe. The risk is low. You've probably at that stage, I mean, I was 30, how old was I when I started the business? So 30.
Mid-30s?
Yeah, 33 I was, right?
Okay.
35. No, I was 35 when I started the business. You know, so I had mortgage and kids and all that pressure that comes with family, where taking the salary is the safer option.
That only makes it more remarkable.
Yeah, probably. Yeah, probably right, mate. But again, I think I wasn't thinking about that at the time. That's not what – it wasn't the desire to run away from the corporate world was so strong that that the downside risk just didn't look that risky to me, you know. And
what about the – that's the downside, but was there also – were you thinking about the upside that if you could make it work, that – the gains would be yours, you'd be able to build your personal wealth? Or was the pain associated with that previous that corporate workplace culture enough to just get you out, and then, you know, survival then and prosperity became an afterthought after that?
No, it's probably a bit of both. I mean, listen, okay. There's no point starting a business and thing is going to fail, right?
Like, yeah, that's right.
That was never, and there were moments, I've got to tell you.
Of course.
We brought on a third equity partner, David, relatively early. It's a good story, actually. So he was in Canada with his girlfriend at the time. He rings me and said, Dom, I'm going to get a job over here. Can you give me a reference? And this is like 2 months after we'd started the business. I said, man, I'm not going to give you a reference, but come back to Australia and work for us, you know, and we'll sort something out on the equity. And we did. And so, yeah, it was a great moment for him, great moment for us. And anyway, after that sort of first year of struggling, I remember he settled a deal which basically allowed – Mike tells the story better than me, but allowed us to buy our kids Christmas presents, right? Because honestly, it was a really tough year. And there were moments where you kind of question yourself, right?
Yeah.
God, have we done the right thing here? I could have been earning that great salary, taking a job somewhere else.
And those particularly doubts, in your industry.
Yeah, and those doubts do creep in. But then you get momentum, right? And the momentum itself feeds on itself.
Yeah.
And we started getting some great wins. We started building out relationships with some terrific clients, which we've still got, you know, 11 years later, and sort of grew organically. But even then, the first few years, mate, we weren't running the business as a business, I've got to tell you. We were just doing deals. Like,
what do you mean by that? Can you explain that a bit more?
Yeah, sure. So the brokerage business, as I said, is just about connecting people who need money with people who have money, and that's banks, non-banks, whatever. But we weren't thinking about the business as a business, if I can put it that way. So we were just doing deals. We ended up then sort of starting what is now our sort of funds management or investments business, because we saw opportunities in market where we could put our own money and some friends and family money together and invest it into transactions. And so that was sort of a very nascent beginning of our investments business, which has grown, you know, materially since those times. But even then it was very transactional, if I can put it that way. We weren't thinking about strategy. We weren't thinking about operations. We weren't thinking about, I mean, I was doing all the finance and accounting stuff because I had that background. So I thought, oh, well, I may as well do that. We weren't thinking about resourcing, you know, all the stuff that I guess I've learned subsequently about business. We didn't even have a why. Whilst we had our principles, we hadn't communicated it to the team. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
We knew what they were, but a lot of good Mike and I know and get written on a piece of paper, but if you haven't communicated to the team, well, they don't mean anything, right? So,
yeah.
What happened? There was a trigger.
Tell me about that.
So this is probably, I don't know, five, six years into the journey where I realized, okay, we've got this great little thing here that's building. And it was probably, again, we had a number of approaches from outside people saying, can we buy in? And I'm thinking, what do you guys want to buy in? What do you guys want to buy in for? Like, and then it kind of realized, oh, okay, we must have something here that's pretty special, right? And so I thought to myself, okay, we need some help, right? We need some external guidance, advice, whatever. So we reached out to an external consultant who took us through this really interesting journey, actually. He said, if we're going to do this thing properly, I need you as equity partners. I need to interview the three of you separately, and you need to be brutally honest, and you might not like the answers that you're going to hear. And so he did that, and then he asked us questions not only about the business but about, you know, our personal ambitions, our personal lives, and where we wanted to be in 5 years, 10 years time, etc. It was a great process because it allowed us to think into the future probably for the first time, whereas we'll kind of thinking about annual plans, you know, at that stage, whereas now we're starting to think about, okay, where do we want to be in 5 years' time? What do we want this organization to look like? Who do we need? And what type of people do we need to take us on that journey? And fortunately for us, for Michael, David and I at the state, at that time there was only three of us as shareholders, we had great alignment. We were all very much the same age, all young families, you know, all wanting to build the business. It wasn't the case that any of us wanted to sell or exit or, you know, maximise the price and sell. And that's still the case. We still want to sort of continue to build out the business, which is great. So with that alignment, he then sort of mapped out our businesses, talked about the advisory business, talked about the investments business. They're very different businesses, right? The customers in those businesses are different. And so then talked about valuations of those businesses. We hadn't even thought about valuation of a business before, right? Like, it was crazy, right? You see, you're 6 years into building a business. Honestly, we'd never looked at the business and said, well, what's this thing worth? Had no idea. And then that allowed us to, you know, just take the business from what was very much a transactional business to, I don't even think we had a business at that stage. I just think we had a group of people together doing deals, right? It then went on the pathway of becoming a business. We looked at scaling. We've obviously scaled the business subsequently. We looked at hiring some pretty important people to the business from a resourcing perspective and adding skills that Mike and I just didn't have or felt that we have but weren't, you know, using our time as best as we could. And I think, yeah, that's been transformational for us as a business, just being able to recognize that we can't do everything personally. We can't do everything together. We need other people on the journey. And, you know, we're in a semi-professional services business, so of course we need people on that journey. We need great people on that journey. And it was that moment in time, which was probably only 4 or 5 years ago, that crystallized, you know, pretty significant growth in the business. We then put in place plans and strategy, and we started reporting back to the team. We put in place internal reporting. We have, I guess, shareholder meetings, which we weren't having previously. You know, all that structure that I guess businesses have when they become businesses.
Yeah. It sounds like this maturing of the business and of the business leaders, which is a beautiful thing to realize the potential, is what I'm hearing. And it's almost like this realization that, wow, the potential, it's right under our nose, and this obligation to kind of live into that potential. I'm interested to know, was there, once you were aware of that, was there a leap of faith that you had to take with investing in the resources and the planning, and had you built up some reserves and, you know, there wasn't so much a leap of faith, it was just starting to live into the plan?
There was a leap of faith because one of the challenges I face personally is just letting go, and, you know, they were founder syndrome, right? The ability to let go of what is something you've created.
Your baby.
It's not easy, right? It's something that's quite challenging. But in order for, again, I think for me, it came down to the business is not Michael and Dom and David. It's a separate thing. And in order for it to become as successful as it can be, you got to let go, right? And I'm learning that, right? I wouldn't say I've completely let go, but I'm learning that. And I think it's through that leap of faith, and it's all about people, right? At the end of the day, taking a leap of faith, bringing on board the right people, there's an exponentially positive outcome. I think it can go the other way, by the way. Taking a leap of faith.
Has it gone the other way in the past?
Fortunately for us, no, it hasn't. So the guys that we brought on board, in particular into strategically important positions, you know, CFO, our head of investments, head of sales, guys running our pipeline, even our joint venture partners that we've entered into other businesses with, you know, we've been very fortunate, I guess, in some extent. But there's also been a little bit of the guys that we've hired into those roles, we had some relationship with. It's not,
yeah,
they weren't blind hires. And so with that meant that the leap of faith was somewhat measured, I suppose.
Yes. Yes.
They never worked in the organization previously, but we dealt with them. We kind of knew how they operated. We knew what values they operated from, what principles they operated from. And so I think from our perspective, yes, there was that leap of faith that was required, but we had also at the same time built up some reserves. So, you know, it was a bet we could afford to take. That's the reality. I mean, we've always built this business organically. We've built it slowly. We talk about, you know, playing an infinite game, you know, Simon Sinek stuff. We've embedded that in the business in terms of ensuring that we're, you know, it's never about the deal. This is the irony. We're now evolved as an organization. It's not about the deal. It's about the customer. It's about the relationship. It's about the partnership that we have with our customers first, and then the transactional stuff, the deal stuff will come later. Whereas when we first started the business, we had it the complete other way around. It was never about the relationship. It was always about the deal, right? Stupid. But, like, you learn, right? And I think, that coming back to your question, that ability to be able to let go, that leap of faith, as you put it, it's critical to allow the business, which is this separate thing, to become what it's going to become, outside of it being Michael, David and Dom, right?
That's great. Thanks for sharing that perspective, because I think there's a lot of listeners, on the episode that's going to relate to their business being their baby. And I think that's one of the ultimate things. Can you do? Can you let go for the greater good? It's not easy, and it's fraught, with non-optimal outcomes. But I mean, you can't grow, and you can't really play a big game or influence on a big stage if you don't. So thanks for sharing that.
It's okay.
Stanford Capital, as we speak, can you give us a picture of where the business is at now, what it's looking like, and what areas you're playing in at the moment?
Yeah, sure. So Stanford Capital, as I said, sort of debt origination business. We've got offices now, Sydney, Melbourne, Brisbane, Adelaide. This year we'll originate and are on target to doing sort of 1.6, 1.7 billion in volumes. Our average deal size is about 9 million, so a lot of transactions going through the business. We see a hell of a lot in terms of transactional activity in each state up and down the capital stack. So, you know, first mortgage, second mortgage and equity opportunities. It's still growing. We've certainly got aspirations of getting to sort of $3 to $4 billion in the next 3 years. So we're very much growing, and that's really through a combination, I guess, of our existing team maturing and hiring more people, which we are continuing to do. In fact, we made an offer to a young salesperson this morning, business development person this morning. It's a great business, you know. It's got great connectivity in relationship with customers. We see repeat deals with those customers. I mean, one transaction we settled for a client a couple of weeks ago was our 28th deal with that particular client, and demonstrates, I guess, the longevity and importance of relationship and having that connectivity and understanding of customers, something we talk about a lot within the business. And obviously allows, with that flow, the pipeline this morning, about $3.3 billion, so from prospect, you know, through to about to be settled. Mm-hmm. So with that, we've then sort of evolved the investments business. So the investments business, put simply, is we manage money on behalf of high net worth families, sophisticated investors. We hold a wholesale financial services license. We are actually raising at the moment. So we're looking to raise $50 million
in our core partners fund number two, our first core partners fund number one. We raised a bit over $27 million. That's fully invested. Likely looks like it's going to return about 18% to our investors per annum, IRR. So great story for our investors, and we're hoping they'll back us again. Even that business has evolved, right? Like, it was doing single transaction, single deal investments through the GFC, through COVID. Mm. We made the decision that we wanted to start raising money in funds. We actually thought at the beginning of COVID, so, you know, March, April last year, that we were going into a, you know, GFC type event. It certainly felt that way at the beginning, and liquidity stopped, right? There was no money in markets in March, April last year. So we thought there was going to be a bit of blood on the streets, and we raised a fund, I guess, anticipating that and thinking that there'd be some opportunistic buying opportunities, development opportunities, you know, to partner with clients. And again, to make it clear, that investments business, we don't go out and buy assets in our own right. It's always in partnership with a client. And it plays in that top tier of the capital stack. So in the equity, preferred equity, mezzanine debt space. So it's very much a partnership model, and it's how we can scale. You know, it's about then seeing the flow through the origination business, and then using that flow to partner with clients that we really like and that we want, and that they're looking for capital, they're capital hungry and want to scale. And we back those guys. So we've done in the investments business probably $500-600 million worth of investments now. That's capital out the door, which would translate to, you know, billions of dollars worth of real estate assets, noting that we tend to play in that top part of the capital stack. Great business, and probably really still growing, right? The reality is we've had one fund which has gone exceptionally well through some pretty tough times through COVID. But again, through the pipeline and the disciplined approach that we take to investing the capital, we're going to go again with Core Partners Fund 2. And that'll take us to another level. You know, we're hiring team members into that team. We've got an independent non-executive investment committee member now, which sits on every investment committee decision we make. So again, it's not Michael and I making those investment decisions in our own right anymore. We're sort of, whilst we're still intimately involved with those decisions, it's not purely our decisions anymore. It's we've got rigor and discipline of a third party independent, as well as the executive team, I guess, running the deals. And look, I can see that business growing further to a point where, you know, it's historically been very transactional in terms of, you know, we do a deal with a customer and sell the asset or realize, liquidate the asset and move on. We're now sort of working on a strategy whereby, you know, we're building this pipeline of assets, which funds management companies around Australia love. In fact, we sell assets to those funds management businesses, and we've only realized in the last 12 months that, well, maybe we should hold on to those assets and manage them ourselves. We've got the skill sets to be able to do so. So we're putting in place.
Yeah, like a built-to-rent kind of?
Similar, I think more in the commercial space. So, okay. You know, we've done deals.
Asset management,
yeah. So we did a deal, for instance, just recently where we developed an asset with a client. It had a lease to Tesla. It was in Miranda in Sydney, 8-year lease. You know, this $30 million asset, we could have kept that asset on the books and continue to manage it. It's not, you know, it's not a difficult thing if you've got the right people. But we've ended up selling that to Charter Hall, who's exchange on it last week. They've yet to settle, so maybe should be a little bit careful about that on this recording. But assuming it does settle, that'll go onto their books, and you know, they'll move on, and we've traded out of the asset. Whereas we're not creating that sort of long term sustainable value that comes with asset management. So I can see how the Core Partners Fund and the investments business evolves down that path. And well, there's an infinite journey there, right?
Yeah.
Ahead of that business.
Sounds like just great synergies from that original business to the investment business to potentially future businesses. It's almost, you know, a wonder of finance in general being so broad, the fact that you can play in all these synergistic style businesses. Do you ever look back at that guy that was in uni and just got back from overseas and say, wow, like I really backed the right horse picking finance? Does that ever strike you?
No, not really. I don't know. I just don't think like that. I mean, it's been interesting having this conversation because, you know, this is kind of a moment where you pause a little bit and do reflect. I tend not to be so, nostalgic, I suppose. Yeah. Listen, part of my job now is thinking forward, right? A big part of my job. In fact, it's pretty much my whole job is thinking about the future and how, where we're going and you know, the strategy that we're on. And the business has evolved. I mean, taking your point about synergies, you know, taking it to a even further step now, we've entered into transactions and bought other businesses or bought into other businesses that are synergistic to us. So we own a share in a business called Blue Crane, which, does mortgages and small business lending and is, again, complementary to what we do in the core business at Stanford. And in fact, one of our clients, a guy called Julian Akkad, who was a client a few years ago, we were talking to him about, and I think you know Julian, yeah?
Yeah.
We were talking to him at the time. In fact, you guys introduced us to him.
Yeah, I think Bill. Bill from my team back in the day.
You did, back in the day.
Relationships, there you go.
So that was, 5 years ago. And we were talking to him about funding a project that he had, and through that discussion realized that, you know, he himself wanted to, he was at that juncture, right, where he was in corporate world and wanting to go out and do his own thing. And we've partnered with Julian and built out a terrific business in Spectrum. I mean, it's got 8 staff now, you know, must have $150, $200 million pipeline of fast food and fuel assets that it's building and again, really ready to scale off the great work that he's put in place and we've done collectively over that last 4 years, and a great marriage, you know, where he's got a great set of skills around identifying and developing assets. We had at that stage capital, access to capital and some business skills, which we're still learning, but we were certainly a lot more aware of business at that junction than we were in 2010 when we started the business. And so, you know, those skill sets coming together, I think, have allowed that business to scale far more significantly than it could have if it was either us or Julian in their own right. And, again, that's something that we're looking to replicate across other asset classes is if we can find another Spectrum type operator who specializes in a particular asset class, hopping out of corporate world. And that's probably the key ingredient, right? Hopping out of corporate world, who wants to go out on their own and needs some help from financing, funding, business perspective. We're actively looking for those type of partners as opposed to, you know, us finding finance and procuring finance or investing in particular transactions with investors. We think that's strategically something that's pretty interesting for us. And this is the sort of entrepreneurial spirit that's built in the business, is that, you know, Stanford started 11 years ago and is now really 5 businesses operating under their own stewardship and their own people and their own guidance and their own strategy and operating in their own right, separate to Mike and me and Dave, right? Like they've got their own pathways that they're going to have to go down. And it's interesting. I thought when I started Stanford it was the deal that excited me, but over time it was never the deal for me. It was always about the ability to be able to build and create a business to bring together people around an idea, around a challenge, around an opportunity that that still excites me, frankly, today. So, you know, the idea of starting a new business tomorrow that's complementary and synergistic to the group is absolutely something that I'm open to, and open, and the organization is open to, for that matter. So, yeah, it's interesting, hey, how you sort of evolve as a person and the business evolves.
Absolutely. I can attest to just kind of spending the last hour with you and knowing that early on in your career wasn't so much about entrepreneurialism as about just doing what was in front of you and doing it really, really well. And now it's almost like I'm seeing almost a bit of your dad's journey. You know, you've got your core, you know, finance capabilities, like he had his core accounting, but your dad, you know, there's a story in that, in how he invested it and was quite entrepreneurial in other businesses. Sounds like it's like, you know, chapter two with his eldest son doing very much the same in different sphere.
Yeah, it's probably a bit of that, mate. There really is.
I'm curious to know, with this opportunity, and I can see it's exciting and there's just so many relationships that can evolve and they continue this snowball effect, which is fantastic. Do you ever get concerned that with the growth may come those, that corporatized culture and some of those things that you, when you started the journey, you were so adamant that you wouldn't be? Do you sometimes wake up and think, hey, wait, are we, is this where we're going? What are we going to do to not be like that?
Yeah. Yeah. It's a great question again. And I think I am conscious of it. Because of what was so high in terms of motivation for me when we started the business. So to put that into context, the whole – so we've got 43 or 44 sort of team members across the different businesses. There's two layers. So there's no management infrastructure. In fact, I hate the word manager. I think, unfortunately, the word manager – has evolved to a point where, you know, a manager should be a coach, right? A manager should be someone who inspires his or her people, who encourages them, who gets the best out of them, who trains them in a coach sense. Whereas I think the word manager in today's world means someone who takes all the glory for the work that their people do, who berates their people, who and this, that's corporate world, right? And
bureaucracy.
Yes, bureaucracy. Like, and one of the I read this really interesting article the other day. It was in the Atlantic. Quoted some data out of Harvard Business Review around how COVID has sort of uncovered the fact that there's this management infrastructure out there which is redundant. You know, I think we're in a world today where systems and people are accountable. Systems can hold people accountable. You don't need a manager to say, did you do that job, right? So therefore, what's the manager there for? You know, if the manager's not there to inspire and to teach and to guide and to coach, then don't be there. Get them out of the way and let the people who are doing stuff do the doing, right? And I think what COVID has done, because those, you know, inverted commas managers aren't able to play the politics, aren't able to go into their boss's office and take glory for what they shouldn't be taking glory for. Mate, it's uncovered them. It really has. And that's what this article was alluding to, was the fact that these managers who were otherwise able to sort of manipulate their way through the organization, almost hide through the organization, they're being uncovered as not doing anything. And if you're not doing anything, you're not needed. Like, move on. For your sake and for the organization's sake. And the numbers the HBR article quoted was it referenced this this bank in Sweden, which had 8,000 staff and three layers. Wow. 8,000 staff and three layers. So from customer facing to the CEO is three layers, right? Now,
gosh,
that's what I want our organization to be. Like, I want the CEO and the business touching customers. You know, the managing director of all the different businesses touching customers, because you got to understand, you got to live and breathe, you got to realize what's going on. The world's changing like so quickly, right? You know, a year ago, no one saw COVID coming.
Yeah.
And so if you're unable to adapt, you're unable to change, you're unable to interact with your customers, understand what they need,
and at the same time you're unable to get your team together, motivate your team, to challenge your team, you can't grow, right? And so this concept of management, you know, to your point around, do you fear the organization becoming something that you dreaded? No, I don't, because it's not going down that path. I think I'm very clear on the fact that we want this business to be very flat in its structure. We have this concept of functional accountability, right? Like everyone knows what their job is. It's like a football team, right? Everyone knows what their job is. Everyone knows what they have to do. Even the management, the coaches know what they have to do, right? So that's the way we think of the organization. It's very much around functional responsibility, individual accountability. I don't want to have to ring one of the guys and say, did you get that job done? No one does that in our business because people just get it done, right? It's just how it works. And of course, we've got systems that measure that and track that for us and report into us. But surely we're in a world now where data systems can provide that information to the coaches that allows you to go back to the team and say, guys, what's going on? Like, what can we do to help? Have we missed something? You know, like,
yeah, yeah,
in a positive way.
Yeah. Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Makes a lot of sense, and I really couldn't have said it myself. In fact, the longer, you know, I work with a lot of business owners and leadership teams, and I almost find, you know, the best managers out there are the ones that don't have to manage. You know, if you don't have to manage, that means you're doing that whole thing right, which means the word in itself is kind of like broken. I think that's why maybe leadership is probably overtaken. You know, the whole management, people talk about more about leadership and more about that coaching, supporting and holding people accountable. You know, we're not there to micromanage and tell people how to do their job, but be really clear, set people up for success and just be there to guide them and coach them. And occasionally there's some tough conversations that need to be had, but it's more about making sure that, if my personal view is, 100% agree, but you've also got to be really, you got to have it really clear in the whole organization that for that to work well, everyone needs to take accountability. Everyone needs to have accountability for their own role, and they've got to live by the values and the purpose of the company. And that's why I think, to your credit, from day dot with Stanford Capital, even prior to that, you know, you, Mike, and David have been resolute on those principles, those core values, and you've kept true to them. And you've obviously been able to use them as a magnet throughout the journey to, you know, attract the right team that really also lives by those values. And I think when you've got a team of people that really embody those values and live it, and they've got that personal accountability, then that negates the need for management.
Yeah, I think it's probably a good point. Good point. And again, this thing coming back to coaching and having a hard conversation, it's like coaches have hard conversations. That's the reality. I mean, if someone hasn't lived by the values, they need to be pulled up by it, right?
Yeah.
And we have those conversations. And in fact, when we're making hard decisions, we think about the values and we say, is this consistent with our values? Like, is this the right thing to do? Is this operating with integrity? Is this being respectful?
Do you find those conversations hard?
No. Not when I say no, I think once you've considered those conversations through the light of the values of the organization, no, I don't find them hard. I think prior to considering those conversations through the light of the values, yeah, they're challenging, right? They're uncomfortable in some respects. But a great person once said to me, feedback is a gift, right? Like, it's all about the intention. Like, if you're saying to your team, you did the wrong thing and belittling them, that's not the right thing. If you're saying to your team, guys, we could have done this better and this is the way perhaps we should have considered it, what do you think? And the intention is to coach, the intention is to make them better, they get it. They're not going to be offended by that. They'll go, yeah, I get that. That makes sense. That does make me better. Next time I'll do that better. Whereas if you're there saying, mate, what did you do that for? You're an idiot. Like, they're going to get their back up and that's the wrong – that's the intention there, is to make you look good as the manager, inverted commas, that shit word that I hate.
Yeah,
you
know? Yeah.
Go for it. And so for me, it's always about the intent.
You know, so if you're having that hard conversation with the intent of making that person, improving that person, aligning them better with the values of the organization, you can't have a bad conversation. You can't.
Yeah, I love it. I wholeheartedly agree. And to build on that, if you're honest and you care about the person, then you both will come out with a stronger relationship.
Mm.
And yeah, that's easier said than done before you have the conversation. But I think that's part of the old, the more experience you get, the more you know you've got to bring yourself to that conversation, and you've got to take responsibility to make sure that relationship is stronger at the back end of that conversation, and then they're going to respect you for it than before it.
Yeah, I'm 100% agree with you. 100% agree with you. It does cut both ways.
Yeah.
Yeah, it does. Yeah, like if the conversation is done in the right way, you do take it. You, as the coach, take a lot out of it. You know.
Yeah. Yeah, mate, I'm so fascinated about this subject. I can tell that you are too. It's probably another whole podcast in just that. But, mate, it's been a great conversation thus far. I've really enjoyed it, and the story of, you know, your career, as well as understanding, you know, the journey that Stanford Capital and the associated businesses have gone through. I think it's a great time that we cut to our final five questions, mate.
Sure, go for it.
Okay. Going to hit you with the first one. Who was your idol growing up?
I'd have to say Dad. As much as there were times when he wasn't my idol, I think subconsciously, he definitely was, right? I mean, so much of his behavior, where those values come from is very much from him, right? So, And that importance of being respectful to your people and looking after your team and, delivering excellence to customers and working hard, that hard work ethic that he instilled in us as boys, there's definitely no doubt that he was a huge influence on my life.
Beautiful, mate.
And continues to be, by the way,
That's awesome. Mate, how do you think your industry is going to be different 10 years from now?
I think digital will play an increasing role. Fintech. I don't think it necessarily replaces relationships, but the way in which relationships and fintech/digital work together will evolve over the next 10 years, and we're sort of working on some stuff in the background on that. I think we'll see consolidation, certainly in the sort of debt advisory brokerage space. I mean, it's an extremely fragmented industry. I think the average size of the firm is two and a half people or something, you know. So I think we will see consolidation, particularly as technology plays an increasing role. Interestingly, there's this massive movement of bankers leaving banks and starting their own origination advisory type businesses. I think that trend will continue, but I also think that trend probably consolidates, i.e. those people, instead of going and starting their own business, may decide to go and work for Stanford, for instance. Technology and consolidation, probably two big themes that we're seeing on the advisory side of the business. In terms of the principal side of the business, investments and spectrum side of the business, I think, again, scale is really important in those businesses to drive efficiency. So probably scale and consolidation in those industries play a big part as well.
Wow. What didn't you know about running a business at the start of your journey that you wished you would have known?
A lot. I think I didn't know a lot at all, to be honest. I think the turning point, as I sort of alluded to before, when we brought in Mark, who was a consultant that worked for us, not you, it was another Mark it was at the time, just made us think about the organization as a separate entity, you know, as its own thing.
I think I wish I'd known that a little bit earlier, or at least contemplated that a little bit earlier. It's not like we were taught that at school, right? We were taught that in law school at uni. Maybe I didn't listen to that lecture, but you know, when you're a founder, it's a very different thing. So,
yeah.
And I think I wish I'd had the ability to reach out to external advisors and consultants earlier. I think that's something that we do a lot of now. You know, we speak to people who are experts in whatever it is, whether it be sort of technology or funds management or people or strategy, operations, whatever it is that we want to focus on, and bring external people into the business. And it's actually really refreshing, right? I mean, as I said at the front end of this conversation, I'm often doubtful, right? And I think with that doubt means I'm open to change, and the organization is open to change. And so bringing fresh set of eyes into the business that can, you know, objectively talk about the business, analyze the business, think about the business in a way that we just can't as we're sort of living and breathing it, is really, really important. And I think that's something that I wish I'd known earlier, that I wish I'd probably done earlier, is to bring in those external voices and those external thoughts into the business, and to leverage those external voices and thoughts earlier.
Mm-hmm. Makes sense. And if you could have earned more money and had more time working for someone else, would you have still run your own business?
I think you know the answer to that question.
I think you're pretty passionate, yes.
Yeah, pretty passionate, yes.
Just confirming, no chance of you going back to ANZ.
No chance. No chance. Even if they offered me the CEO role, mate, no way.
that speaks volumes, mate. And, Dom, what does success in business mean to you?
Yeah, this isn't an easy question to answer. I think for me, it's seeing our people evolve and become great. Yeah, it's not financial. You know, what's winning? Winning is a really hard thing to define, right? My definition of winning is going to be different to yours.
Yeah.
So for me, it's really about seeing the growth in our people and seeing how we've had guys that we've hired as graduates who are now just doing amazing stuff, you know, and knowing that we've in some small way contributed to their life journey, and hoping at some point in time they look back on their life and think that their time at Stanford was just the most amazing time in their life from a career perspective. That's success for me. I reckon if our people, as they're closing out their individual careers, look back and say, that was just the best time of my life from a career perspective, then, yeah, that's really success for me.
Dom, that's a beautiful way to end the podcast. And, mate, I'm so appreciative of you spending the time with our listeners to really unpack your life journey and understand a bit more about, you know, Stanford and what you've been able to create. You know, I've gotten a lot out of just listening to the story. I feel like I've, you know, lived a lifetime of what it's been like to be in your shoes. Before I let you go, if any of our listeners want to connect with you online, what would be the best way they can do that?
Yeah, I'm on LinkedIn. That's probably the primary way. Otherwise, look up our website. I've got my webpage and my email address and my phone number on the webpage. So, yeah, drop me a note, drop me a text, give me a call.
Great. And I just had this thought, particularly if you have one of those complimentary businesses, you know, and if you don't know what I'm talking about, just rewind probably 30 minutes back. Dom just put out there, you know, always open to, you know, people that, you know, probably live the values and have interesting businesses that could complement what you guys do. Just kind of throw it in there, nice and short. But
yeah, thanks, Mark.
No worries. And I'll put the your details in the show notes as well. Dom, thanks again for coming on the show, mate. I really appreciate your time, and it's been great to hear your story.
No, Mark, thank you, mate. It's been really nice to reflect, actually. It's something that I don't do often enough. It's a good reminder for me to reflect a little bit more frequently, and I've enjoyed the conversation.
Thanks, Dom.
Cheers, Mark.